Alternatively, we can take vectors J, M. These vectors are labeled by the total spin, and this is under FU2. The total spin and the component of the spin. These form a vector space of dimension 2j plus 1. And for j equals 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, and so on, we get one vector of each dimension n equals 0 to infinity. So that space of vector representations of FU2 is probably equivalent to this one. Actually, this one's bigger because we have spinners. This one only can contain spin 1, spin 2, spin 3, and even this isn't just spin 2. The traceless symmetric part of this is spin 2, but it also has an anti-symmetric part that's spin 1, and it's got a trace that's spin 0. So this doesn't behave in a simple way, as simple a way as the JM vectors do. So this is a better way to represent our group. You've perhaps seen this in E&M, where you have the spherical harmonics, the Y, L, M, at theta and phi. You know that any function on the sphere can be expanded in terms of each. Right, some linear combination for all L and M. Well, this is just another name for these guys. Right, the integer ones of these are the spherical harmonics. The fact that if we put them in a coordinate basis, R theta phi, let's say, right, in that coordinate basis, those vectors become the spherical harmonics, precisely. We don't need the R, but in spherical coordinates. Those are the spherical harmonics. So you're actually used to finding this form of the representation way back in E&M. It's just that you didn't know the interaction group theory. But there's a systematic approach going on here. So is everybody comfortable with the JM states under FU2? Alright, FU2, we have one vector of each dimension. You can find a proof I know there's one in Thackeray, if you want to look that up. If you have questions on it, I'm happy to go through that. There's probably also a proof of it in Leibovitz. I'm pretty sure there is. I mean, this is something that is typically covered in the spin section of the quantum mechanics book. You'll find it there, showing that you can classify state this way. Essentially, what you do, you're talking about 2x2 matrices, and no more than two independent matrices can be diagonal at the same time. That means that you can come up with at most two eigenvalues, so you choose the overall magnitude and the z component to be those two. It's an arbitrary choice. So you choose two things to label your states, and everything else is going to mix up. Okay. Our goal then is going to be to use what you know about FU2 to characterize what else the FL2C does. And to do that, we need the generators. So let's lambda be an element of FL2C. Let's call it for encapsulation. We can call it lambda. Then look for the infinitesimal generator. Let lambda equal the identity plus some epsilon. Well, these are matrices. These are transformation matrices. There really are some indices here. Let me call them AB. And contra AB plus epsilon AB. What's the range of A and B?
Two?
Or yeah. Two. Two-dimensional matrices, so they don't run very far. So, now, let's see, what does it mean for this thing to be an SL2C? The determinant needs to be 1. Otherwise, it can be pretty much anything. Well, the, let's let epsilon be alpha beta mu nu. Then lambda is 1 plus alpha beta mu 1 plus nu. And we demand determinant of lambda equal 1.
And no second order terms.
Yeah, and all the second order terms go away, so this is going to be really trivial. So let's just take the determinant. We get 1 plus alpha times 1 plus nu minus u beta. But we're throwing out second order terms. That's essentially zero. So we have 1 plus alpha plus alpha nu minus u beta. And those second terms we can neglect. So that will be true if and only if alpha plus nu equals zero. And that's just a trace of epsilon. So alpha plus nu is a trace of epsilon. And that's required to be zero. So any traceless generators are allowed. Other than that, anything goes. So we need to find some clever way of writing an arbitrary traceless 2x2 matrix. And if I take epsilon to be let's write it in a funny way, adding and subtracting epsilon dagger. Right, that's certainly a true statement. But notice that the first term is Hermitian, and the second term is anti-Hermitian, where by Hermitian I mean Hermitian. By anti-Hermitian I mean anti-minus Hermitian. So we just pick up a minus sign on that second term as we take the dagger. Well, you can do this with any matrix. You can always write any matrix, a real matrix, you can write as a symmetric plus an anti-symmetric. So, it's much easier to find a simple basis for Hermitian or anti-Hermitian matrices. What's the basis for Hermitian, traceless Hermitian matrices?
SU2.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, sigma equals sigma dagger, and trace sigma equals zero. Let's see. The, Now, is there anything funny about the trace here? Yeah, I'm just wondering if but what would happen if it could be possible for the trace of H not to be zero, but for the trace of epsilon to be zero? done.
One of those parts traces? Well,
if it were anti-symmetric, it would be traceless. But, you know, one example of, I can have I minus I, but that is traceless. Let's see. So, there is an anti-Hermitian matrix there. That's anti-Hermitian, but it's not traceless. Right? Anti-symmetric is necessarily traceless. But anti-Hermitian is not.
So it requires that epsilon be traceless, so both parts have to be traceless, right? The Hermitian and Schirmer.
Yeah, and let's prove that. So we know that the trace of epsilon has to be zero. And that's the trace of H plus the trace of A. If the trace of epsilon equals zero, then the trace of epsilon dagger will also be zero. But that means that zero is the trace of epsilon dagger. The trace of epsilon dagger is the trace of H minus the trace of A. So if I combine these two equations, it implies that trace H has to be zero separately from trace A. They both have to be traced, so we're okay. The traceless, the Pauli matrices form a basis for all traceless Hermitian matrices. We proved that a time or two ago. What's the basis for the anti-Hermitian matrices? Anybody think of one?
I times?
Bingo.
Oh, right. Again.
I think. So, we're going to have to be a little careful here because those look an awful lot like cities. So, and we'll give them different names and just sort of know what they are, really. But the trace by sigma, of course, is zero, so we're good. So, we can write everything as a sum of our general epsilon can be written as a sum of some ui sigma I plus some vi I sigma I. But you can see we need to be a little bit careful here. So let's call these j's and k's. What should I let j be?
Sigma or I turn to sigma? You want j to turn into rotation, so I'm guessing we're going to want
sigma's problem.
I think. You want SU2. Alright. If I'm going to exponentiate a generator with real coefficients, then I'm going to want that I. So the exponential of I VI sigma I. Remember the I pi over 2?
Yeah.
Now you have to either put an I explicitly up there, or use that generator for J. So let's just use that generator for J. I hope I'm not differing from the notation in our text too much, but I've gotten in the habit of writing my lead groups. we'll change this to agree to the text as we get into it a little more. But I do a lot of work with lead groups, and to keep track of signs and generators and structure constants and all the things that come with lead groups, I'm always careful to exponentiate with real parameters. It's real parameters that define a lead group. The structure constants are real. You did not find this practice followed in quantum mechanics for a simple reason. Suppose I have, let's say, J. Right? So what is that? That's I sigma I commutator I sigma j. So we get a minus sign, and then the commutator of I sigma j is 2i epsilon ijk sigma k. And now I recognize that I sigma k is another j, so I get minus 2 epsilon ijk times jk. And I see I've got the usual rotation algebra. I might want to normalize it with a factor of 2, but this is the way I would usually do it. However, j is anti-Hermitian, so it's non-observable. And in quantum mechanics, we want Hermitian operators for everything in sight, because those will be observable. So when we're doing quantum theory, we stick in an I by hand. So in quantum theory, what we do is we let the group element be the exponential of I times an element of the Lie algebra. Something like that. Ui sigma I plus vi times I sigma I. Too many I's, sorry about that. So you exponentiate a generator to get a group element. This will be lambda, the function of ui's and vi's, vj's. So six real parameters. But it has the advantage now of the generator, these generators at least are Hermitian. So it's these generators that become the observables. So if we're going to insert an I here, then we choose J to be the sigma. That makes the rotation generators Hermitian, so they're observable. So we can observe the components of angular momentum, the angular momentum operator. Now, let me see. I'm sure he's going to do it this way. Let's do it that way. Let's make that identification. So all this means is that when we exponentiate the Lie algebra to recover the Lie group, we're going to put an I up there. And that means that we're choosing the generators of any unitary group to be Hermitian operators. So that means that the generators of Hermitian groups, right? Remember, any unitary transformation can be written as e to the I times the Hermitian thing. So what we're doing is we're arranging things so that all the unitary transformations that we do in quantum mechanics have an associated Hermitian operator in the Lie algebra. When you look at the commutation relations, you'll find there's always an I sitting here, right? And that, again, violates the usual convention with Lie groups, but that's okay. It's because we've chosen our generators in these cases to be Hermitian. So, it's just a convention with Lie groups, and you know, those who are doing research with me, be aware that that's not the convention I'll follow, but it will be what Maggiore and most field theory books will do. Okay, and any question on that? You see, the general point is a simple thing, really. It's just where you stick an I. Okay, so I'm going to let the J's be the sigmas and the K's be the I sigmas. But I'm going to expect to get an I in my commutation relation. So the group elements are going to be the exponentials of I times linear combinations of the generators. And with that, I let Ji be sigma I, I let Ki be I sigma I. And I want to find the commutation relations of these guys. Well, we know what they are. We can write them down almost immediately. Ji with Jj is just a commutator of two Pauli matrices. And that's 2i, that's one ijk, sigma k. And as promised, we pick up an I over here. So our structure constants are pure imaginary because of the way we've chosen these generators. Now let's try a j with a k. Ji with kj is sigma I with I sigma j. So we have an extra I floating around. Then we get 2i F1 ijk sigma k. Now we've got two I's here. So we want to keep one I because we've made this funny choice of generators. So I need to associate that I with that sigma. So I'm going to write this as 2i F1 ijk I sigma k. And I identify that as a k. And then finally, a K with a K. Here. So I get two I's now. So there's an overall minus sign in the commutator of two Pauli matrices. So we get minus 2i, F1, I, J, K, sigma K. We keep an I here, so this is a J. So this gives us the Lie algebra of SU, FL2C. So the commutator of 2J, oh, I'm sorry, I should have reinterpreted this as a J. Let me write this thing here so we can just look it down. So the commutator of 2J's is 2I, that's one IJK, JK. Now, what can you tell me just looking at that?
It's closed.
It's closed. That means that the J's in themselves form a subgroup, generate a subgroup. Well, if that you could. Then a J with a K. Oops. Then what do we get here? 2i. And we get a K. And then 2k's. Give a J. What's that tell you about the K's? Yeah. They do not generate a subgroup. They go back into the J's. This is the origin of Thompson precession, by the way. Precession, it's a precession of the electron spin in an atom. What happens is, in order to analyze the gyroscopic motion of the electron in the field of the proton, you go to an accelerating frame of reference. You actually end up boosting twice. You boost to the instantaneous rest frame of the electron, and then if you're looking at how it evolves, okay, it's accelerating, so there's a second boost. Well, the two boosts don't commute. They actually generate some rotation. So looking at the rate of change of how you have to boost by doing a second boost leads to some anomalous rotation. This is the Thompson precession. I think Jackson discusses that at some point. Probably not in those terms. But I think in its relativity chest, though, it is appropriately in the relativity thing. So that's a nice physical consequence of that commutator. Now, that's nice. We could exponentiate this. We could find what the generators look like and start doing boosts and rotations with some sort of elements of SL2T. Good exercise. Explore that.
So right now, is this equivalent to the, we found J and K that are 4x4 matrices.
Real 4x4 matrices forming SO31.
Okay.
The 2-to-1 cover.
Okay.
Right, this is the covering group.
Okay.
Now, let's see, how do we see that? Remember how we first established that SL2C was indeed the Lorentz group. Right? We let X mu sigma mu be T times the identity plus X dot sigma. Right? So that's our new capital X thing. And our transformation for A an element of SL2C, we said that we're going to let X prime be A X A dagger. That preserves the hermeticity, and hermeticity is all we have to preserve, so A can be anything as long as it's unit determinant. Non-unit determinant, we have this funny phase floating around that just goes away. Okay, so this is how you do a Lorentz transformation. So recall. So exercise 2. Use SL2C to perform, let's say, a boost. So check that you get the usual Lorentz boost. If you, take a boost in the X direction or something, you can probably figure out easily enough which generator that will be, and exponentiate that. See that you get a boost. Maybe that's just an extension of exercise 1 here. I mean, you can exponentiate these and find some group elements, but then use those group elements to do one or two transformations and see that these really give you a Lorentz transformation. It'll be much like what we have. But you aren't doing it with 2x2 complex matrices this time. And so you want to see that that really works. I want to take some combinations of these things. Let's let J plus or minus the J plus or minus I and K. Now, that's not really very legal. It gives us, looks like two copies of J then. if we back up and think of this in terms of the polymatrices. So let's carefully not back up and think of these in terms of the polymatrices. Let's just form these combinations and look at what happens with the commutators. So if I take J plus with J plus, all right, then that's JI plus I KI, JJ plus I KJ. J and K are independent. So we know what they are, we know their commutation relations. We can write down some explicit matrices for them. So it's okay to take these combinations. But what happens then is two J's give us 2i upon ijk. Well, we're always going to have that. So the J with the J gives us a jk. Then a J with a K, we're going to have that I coming along. Then J with a K gives us a K. And then we have K with a J.
minus.
All right. That minus. Well, what is that? Let's just check that. A little side over here. Up here. The thing that's a little tricky is that the indices are flipped too. It's KI with JJ. This is JI with KK. So I want to know what I KI JJ is. That minus I JJ KI, which is minus I, and then a J with a K is 2I epsilon. So on. So I get 2i epsilon, but notice j I k and then k k. So if I interchange the I j here, I'm going to have I kind of 2i epsilon I j k k k like that. So it looks to me like I get two of these things. Is that what I expect? Yeah, I guess that's okay. So I'm going to get another term like this one. Those two add up. And then the 2k, there's an overall minus 1 from the i's. Then a k with a k, this sign becomes a plus, and we get 2i epsilon I j k j k. So we get two copies of 9JK, JK. It seems like I should have put a half in all this. Let's see. If I had put a half in here, would that work? Let's do that. Suppose I take half that. Then I've got a half here and a half there, so there's an overall quarter. So instead of two here, I have a half. And instead of a four there, I just end up with one. Doesn't matter. It's the rotation algebra. It's the Lie algebra of FU2. Yeah, we can normalize it various ways to, you know, do the optimal back thing when you write up a polished copy of your notes. Does everybody see that we're getting, so J plus and J plus are generators of FU2. We're going to have the same thing with J minus and J minus.
Is that the J plus at the bottom?
Sorry. That is a J plus.
Okay.
Yeah, J plus I K twice. Yeah. So the J pluses closes an FU2 algebra. If you look at the J minuses, and does he have the two in there or not? Probably makes sense to try and agree with Nadiri's notation a little bit. Yeah, he does have the two. Okay, good. So, this is the definition here. That's what you like. So, we're going to get the same thing. What's different? We have a minus sign here and a minus sign here. It means the cross terms are going to be negative, and that just means that we get two copies of J minus. Everybody see it? Now let's look at a plus or a minus. So we have a quarter, we have JI plus I KI. Then we have J minus I KJ. So, what's going to happen? We have a quarter. We're going to get a 2i epsilon i j k. and then various stuff. So the J with the J gives a J back. I and a, times a K with a K, J, which one? Oh, this one. Let's do this one. This pair is just there. So we get plus I, then our 2i epsilon, and a k. Then we have minus I, a j with a k. J with a k gives us a k. That goes away. And then finally here, we have a pair of k's. We've got I times minus I, so there's a plus one. Then we have a k with a k, and the k with a k has a minus sign here. So we get minus j for that commutator, and the whole thing is zero. So there's something very nice here. We have two copies of SU2 generators that commute with one another. We're going to use these to label our state. And we already know that we can label states. Label state of SU2 by a J and an M. So these states we're going to label by two copies of J M states. So we can think of the Lie algebra of SL2C in as acting on states that we can label by call it J plus M plus and J minus M minus. We'll have to check how he labels these, but this gives us it gives us more space. So now what happens? Now if we have two different J's, it's just like addition of angular momenta in quantum mechanics. When you have a product state, that product state could act like anything from J plus J minus down to J plus minus J minus. Yeah, after that is J plus minus J minus. Because the spins can be aligned or anti-aligned or anything in between. So this direct product of possible JM states actually gives you a superposition, which you can break down in the usual Clebsch-Gordan coefficient sort of way. So you may want to take a look at your quantum book on the Clebsch-Gordan section too. Just insofar as taking products of state, and we can work through some examples of that if you want to see some. Let me pause and ask for questions. Not the question. You're scowling at me. That's okay. He has a little aside, a little marginal note, pointing out that SL2C is not the direct product of 2SU2. Right, because the generators are not J and IK. The generators of SL2C are J and K. Right? We exponentiate those with an I and a parameter, and those are the group elements. So we don't get the Lorentz group if we exponentiate these. If we exponentiate these, we actually get SL4. We get four-dimensional rotation through the covering group SL4, spin 4.
So is it the extra copy that we have that makes that happen?
that makes what happen exactly?
That makes the bumps up from these SL2C to L4 or whatever.
This extra I that we're throwing into the K, putting in an I is going to change some signs somewhere. Well, it basically changes the signature of the whole problem, so that you're now preserving a Euclidean 4 metric instead of a Lorentzian 4 metric. Mm-hmm. Right, that's the way it happens. So you end up with two rotation groups. You really have six rotations in four-dimensional Euclidean space. So it really can be written as two copies of SU2. SU2 is a pure rotation. So if we try to exponentiate this, we find that we goofed because everything is compact, it's all rotation. But it's perfectly good for labeling states. Alright, any little complex two-vector can be characterized by how it transforms under each of these SU2s, and we can use the SU2s to label it. If we want to find the full Lorentz transformation that acts on those states, then we have to exponentiate J and K. But in order to label two component spinners, it's perfectly valid to choose these labels. And this is done. It's done in various ways. If you look at Ken Rose and Riddler, the theory of spinners or something. Spinners in space-time. Penrose introduced a notation where you write every four vector with a pair of indices. And you've got to do a bit of work to actually figure out how these things transform. But you think of a Pauli matrix as something with one index of each kind. And, each of these runs 1 to 2, right? But you find, if you transform the Pauli matrix, never mind the mu. For mu equals 0, you've got the identity. For mu equals I, you've got the three Pauli matrices. But if you think of those as doubly contravariant matrices, then the first SU2 acts on one index, and the second SU2 acts on the other. So the effect of Lorentz transformation decouples into one kind of action on this and the other on that. Those two groups commute, so the dotted and undotted indices don't know about each other. So in this notation, you end up writing all vectors. Every vector index gets replaced by a pair of spinner indices, one of the left kind and one of the right kind, one of the plus kind, one of the minus kind. Right? And those act independently. There's a whole notation built up around this. Maggiore does not use that dotted index notation, so we're not going to venture there. But I wanted to give you a heads up about that. You will see that sometimes. It turns out to be a very powerful tool for analyzing tensors in general relativity. One of the reasons is that you also have, since it's a two-dimensional space, you have a two-dimensional Levy-Civita tensor. And it's got to be plus or minus that one. You also have one in the dotted space, so you just think of these two-dimensional spaces as totally independent of one another. And this is the same matrix numerically, but it's distinct. And what you find is that any anti-symmetric pair, all right, we're talking 2x2s here. There's only one anti-symmetric matrix. So if I have some tensor that's got that's anti-symmetric. So if I have a rank 2 tensor, keep it all contravariant. So if this is minus KBA, then I know that I can write it as something proportional to epsilon. You end up using epsilon sort of like a convenient, albeit anti-symmetric, metric for these spaces. And it's not hard to find that lambda, because you can put an inverse epsilon on TAB, and that's lambda and an inverse epsilon here, and that trace of the product is, well, plus or minus 2, depending on what that turns out to be here. This is actually a product, a trace of epsilon times its transpose. So you get a 2. So you need lambda to be equal to a half. Right. So what you end up with is TAB can always be written as this is a half times epsilon CD, PCD. So you get this scalar out of T. And then you write it as an epsilon. This simplifies a lot of expressions. So the electromagnetic field, right, F mu nu, that's anti-symmetric. What that means is that if I saturate this with a mu a dot and a sigma nu b dot, I get something that's got a dot b, b dot. So the dots and undotted commute with one another. You can write the a dot and b dot. This is the same as a dot b dot. You could write it that way just as well. And because this is anti-symmetric, you can show with a little bit of work that it's not all that hard. You can show that the anti-symmetry has to show up in one or the other pair here. So you can show that FAB A dot B dot is some symmetric thing, phi AB times epsilon A dot B dot, plus the complex conjugate of phi A dot B dot times epsilon AB. You can write the electromagnetic field this way. And if you follow through and put all these poly matrices on here, you can show that phi AB is something dotted into a poly matrix. It must be a double E. So the undotted poly matrix. That must occur every time. But the point is, this ends up being E plus I. Right? And the conjugate is just E minus IB. So you decompose the electromagnetic field into one complex three vector that turns out to have some very nice properties in its rotation. We're not going to do anything with this, okay? This is just an aside for your information. If you want to play with some of these ideas, there are sources out there. Wald's General Relativity book goes into this notation and uses it very effectively to find the Petrov types. Petrov classified possible forms of the Riemann curvature tensor based on symmetries of the gravitational field, how many fundamental symmetries the gravitational field has. But it has everything in the world to do with the with this decomposition. In fact, you find that the curvature tensor, which unfortunately now has 8 indices, can be written as ABCD with a pair of epsilons. And then there's a cross term type thing, psi AB, with 3 epsilon. And then there's a scalar called chi with 4 epsilon. Plus the complex conjugate of all that, where you've got the complex conjugate of that field with undotted. Well, you've seen this decomposition because that's the traceless part of the Riemann curvature, the Weyl curvature. This is the traceless part of the Ricci tensor, and that's the Ricci scalar. So these are, in fact, the Lorentz invariant pieces of the Riemann curvature tensor that just come right out of this analysis automatically. The Petrov type. These coefficients are totally symmetric. If they weren't totally symmetric, you could pull another epsilon out apart and get some other pieces. But phi ABCD, you can show that you can write this as the product of the symmetrized product of 4 two-component spinners. Each of these corresponds to a certain null direction in space-time. But the Petrov types are simply, okay, one type is where all 4 of those k's are different. One type is where any 2 are the same, and the other 2 different. One type is where 2 are the same, and the other 2 are the same. One type is where 3 are the same, and the final type is where all 4 are the same. And those are that add up to 5. Those are the Petrov. Much more complicated if you try to do it with the usual vector notation.
In the first case, with 4 indices?
Yeah.
Is that last line the result?
Oh, this down here?
No, up. The down? That one.
That's the conjugate. Just take the complex conjugate.
Right, okay. And that's the form for electromagnetism?
The F is electromagnetism, yeah. This is E and M here. This is general relativity. This is E and M. And you get these simplifications because the Maxwell field tensor or the Riemann curvature tensor, alphabet and mu, they've got a lot of anti-symmetry in them. And you can use that to pull out epsilon in various places. Okay. So, what we really need to be sorting out is, it turns out that there are different types of spinners. These things are going to act on, these things are little two-component spinners, you know, we've got some chi A, say. One of these vectors, say a plus one. We can think of these things as J plus J minus pairs, right? Where J plus tells us that we've got a vector of magnitude 2J that transforms under the J pluses. Or J minus tells us we've got a spinner that transforms when we do a J minus transformation. And I think these are complex conjugates of one another, right? Because notice that if you take the conjugate here, the I plus fine, so it turns J plus into J minus. I'm not quite sure. Now, it's really, let me think, it's parity that does it. Let's look what happens to these under parity. Do we still have a quorum? Do you guys all go to the picnic tonight? There's a picnic dinner.
And volleyball. He prepares for volleyball.
Oh, dangerous. It's down in the park in Nidley. Okay. You know the Maverick Station in Nidley?
No, I did not.
If you drive, you know, out past Macy's and on down towards Paradise, Nidley's that first little town you come to before you get to Hiram. And
it's on the right.
Yeah. You turn off to the right. On the left there's a Maverick, a road coming in and a Maverick, and then there's a little jog and then a road off to the other front. This is the left. the Maverick's on the left. There's another little gas station on the right, and you turn just past that.
All right.
And there's a park very shortly down that road. And yeah, so Bluffo plays all the dollars in hamburgers. That's it.
F5 is the volleyball, and 6 is the actual serving his food.
So volleyball as soon as anybody gets there with the ball. And then, so what time is the food?
6, I think, yeah.
Oh, look forward to that. CC? Complex conjugate.
Oh, meaning the dot is K.
Yeah, just in exchange all the dots for undotted and undotted for dotted. And put a bar on the field. So it would be a flat bar if you want the complex conjugate of the field. The epsilons are real, so the conjugation doesn't affect them.
So, in English, what is the advantage of the Petrov type?
It's a classification of solutions in general relativity.
Is this in the category of representations?
It comes from representation theory. This structure does. But actually, Petrov discovered this before anybody had developed all of this. It turns out that you remember the Veil curvature, the traceless part of the Riemann curvature, right? You subtract off a bunch of reaching tensors and metrics, and you get something that, you know, any trace you take of it is zero. The Riemann curvature can be decomposed into that piece plus the reaching tensor. And in vacuum, the reaching tensor is zero. So it's really the Veil curvature tensor that characterizes gravity. Right? That's the thing that's characterizing what the gravitational field is, you know, how the curvature is affecting things. So Petrov classified different forms of the Veil curvature. What he found is that you can always completely characterize that traceless part of the curvature by 4 null vectors. four like four vectors. You can get them from these kappas here. These are spinners that each spinner, and any two component spinner determines a null direction. You'd have to, let's see, what would you do? But if you took one of these kappas and you sandwich a Pauli matrix between a pair of them, you get some four vector. Turns out that four vector is always null. So that's the connection between this and what Petrov found, which was there are four null directions that characterize any gravitational field. Right. And you have various special cases. It's possible you get various degeneracies in those four null directions. Sometimes two of them are the same. Sometimes three of them are the same. Sometimes they're all the same. And those are that's the Petrov classification of different geometries based on certain kinds of symmetry of their gravitational field. It's nice. It gives you a way to break down solutions and say, oh, this solution is a Petrov type 2. You get to say stuff like that and you know what you're talking about. So how does J change under parity? If I invert the spatial coordinates, what happens to J?
Back to the same.
Yeah, why? Just for the reason you're thinking, I'm sure, but what kind of quantity is it?
It's like a square. I don't think it's squares, but yeah.
It's that angular momentum. J is the angular momentum operator. So it's r cross p. You know, at least for little j integers, for integer j, these j operators are the orbital angular momentum r cross p. For spin half, for fermionic states, you think it's intrinsic spin, so not R cross P, but the parity is still the same. It's odd under parity. R cross P, okay, R goes to minus R, P goes to minus P, but R cross P stays the same. So J is unchanged by the parity operation. K, on the other hand, it's like the time component. So instead of R cross P, you've got something like what would it be? Either energy cross R, or you've got time cross momentum. Well, the time and energy don't change under parity, so you get one sign. So K does change sign. Another way to see that K changes sign, K is a boost. Right, you put the sign, you put the direction of velocity. So a boost reverses under parity, but a rotation does not. So what happens is the parity operator turns J plus into J minus.
Right.
So if I have a field that, you know, it's like a, let's say you have a 1-0, the parity operation is going to take this to 0-1 type of thing. So we have a way to turn these into one another. So a discrete transformation, parity, can take us between these two types of spinners. What that tells us is that some interactions, like electromagnetism and the strong interaction and gravity, everything but the weak interaction, they preserve parity. So they ought to be described by, you know, to the degree that a spinner participates in the weak interaction, it should not be symmetric between these two. Whereas a spinner that interacts electromagnetically, or a quark, a spinner describing a quark, right, it's got to be symmetric under parity, so these two kinds of spinner will enter symmetrically. You can easily construct spinners that are symmetric in these two. And they're essentially four component objects. Those are the draft spinners. We can get at them directly using another representation for the Lorentz group. But the, and we can describe the electromagnetic and the strong interactions as interactions between those Dirac spinners. We can write the actions of those in terms of Dirac spinners. The weak interaction requires, at one level or another, depending on how you write things, but it really requires either the 1-0 type or the 0-1 type. You know, just these a single two-component spinner, either the plus type or the minus type. Well, you can call them left-handed and right-handed. So, since parity takes you from one to the other, it takes a left-handed system to a right-handed system. So, we think of these two types as left-handed spinners and right-handed spinners. And you can get at them from a top-down way. We could introduce the four-component Dirac spinners, and then we could introduce the parity operation. There's a projection operator that projects the left-handed and right-handed pieces of a Dirac spinner. And those projections are what come into the weak description of the weak interaction. As a combination of a vector and an axial vector. Basically a 1 plus or minus gamma 5 factor in something like the Dirac action that restricts you to working with only, say, the left-handed spinners. So you stick in that projection operator anywhere that it makes a difference and make sure that everything inside is just the left-handed spinners. So we only have DSAT J plus and some no part that transforms into that. So he promises a little ways down the line we'll look at the Dirac spinners. I'm not sure where we get this. I need to spend some time looking at the book. In fact, see Dirac field, page 31, so we're not far from that. He builds them up. His first introduction is not far from where we are. He builds up from these are called veil spinners. He builds up the Dirac spinners from the veil. There's another kind of two-component spinner. And instead of saying, all right, I want my two-component spinners to be left-handed, or I want my two-component spinners to be right-handed, I can make them. I can demand that they be real. Right. So, if I take a Dirac spinner and restrict it to be real, I've got half the degrees of freedom that I did before, and such a spinner is called a Majorana spinner. So, we'll be encountering three kinds of spinners: Dirac, Veil, and Majorana. The Dirac spinners are the four-component spinners that you get by taking like the square root of the Klein-Gordon equation, and that whole construction. I think we went through that at one point last year. The veil spinners that are handed, either left-handed or right-handed projections of the Dirac spinner, and the Majorana spinners, which are real spinners. And we'll get to all of those. So have y'all got your books now? Okay, good. One of my screen coupons. Hey, who is it? Oh. I'm here. Okay.
You're here for the same.
Oh.
Kidding.
Okay. Let me tap that. I'm tired. Hey, let me give you just a few here. Let's see. Does anybody need like an even number?
Four of us.
Yeah, four. Yeah. Okay. There you go. Now let's see. Four. Yeah, four is the best number.
There are two types of file centers and four types of Dirac centers. And how many types of
Types of spinners.
So
Dirac, Vail, and Majorana.
So are the file centers the projections of the Dirac centers? And there's four.
Yeah.
So there's four Dirac centers, correct? Four types.
Four components.
And then the projection ends up having two. And then the Majorana, are those real? Those are all real.
Those are real. Yeah.
And so there are only two.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah, I suppose you could divide a Dirac spinner into almost two Majorana spinners. You know, this one goes five times that one. So you have half the degrees of freedom. So you can probably write it in terms of a single complex two-component spinner where the conjugation interchanges positions. I think he defines them in the chapter here.
If they're real?
Let's see. So, let's see how it works. Anyway.
Do you think these are all in the...
I would have given you a coherent lecture on this, but I certainly didn't have a chance to look at it all yet. So, long about page 30, he starts getting into this. So, Vail field, page 31, Majorana field, page 33, Dirac field, page 32. And, yeah, so for a Majorana spinner, equation 2.93, he's taking a four component Dirac spinner where the first two components are a left handed spinner and the last two components are a transformed version of that conjugate. So you're multiplying by pulse, the sigma 2. Right, and you see the I sigma 2 there? That's just epsilon. That's just the epsilon AB. Right? I sigma 2, you've got minus I and I times another I makes it real. So that's just the epsilon. Right, or it might be minus that. It's minus that. So you have to define the charge conjugation operation. And in addition to taking the conjugate of fields, it interchanges some things. Because, charge conjugation is going to change the relationship between J and K. You know, J plus is going to go to J minus or something, too. Let me see if I can find that. There's this description.
That paragraph in between.
Okay. sine charge conjugation on the right-handed sphere as minus I sigma 2 psi r conjugate. So you take the conjugate of the spinner field, but you also multiply by epsilon. So it's going to interchange the components. Right, that epsilon is going to interchange the two components of the two component spinner and change the sign of one of them. So you don't just get the component conjugate, you're shuffling the components as well.
Considered independent. That doesn't reduce very nicely.
Well, actually, yeah, it does reduce nicely. There's a systematic way. I could remind you guys about Seth Gordon's coefficient and how you reduce something like that. Is it this? Probably not. Let's see. In quantum yet?
Yeah, I'm in the quantum place.
Yeah, you'll probably see it in there. Yeah, there's a way of... do you guys remember the Clutch Gordon coefficient? Yeah, how you express something like this as a sum of things? You can actually... let me show you that.
I think that I can probably do it next week, so it's okay.
Let's see. So if I've got, I'm trying to think of an example. The simplest example is helium. So I've got a helium atom. It's got two electrons in it. And I want to know what state those electrons can be in. Well, each one is a spin-half particle. And the possible states, there are four possible states. You know, I can have up, 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 down, down, up, or down, down. So, clearly, there's two times two states. But what I want to be able to write them not as up, up, or up, down states. I want to be able to write them as singular, a single angular momentum multiplet. So, what you do is you say, okay, a half, suppose they both have spin up. Well, if they both have spin up, now the spins are aligned, that's actually the same as a 1-1 state. Right? They're both aligned, so the total angular momentum adds, and the z components add. So it's as if you have a spin 1 state. And now, what you do, you analyze SU2, and you find that the operators JX plus or minus IJY, okay, you define a different J plus and J minus than what we've been doing here. You define this operator, and you find that J plus or J minus raises or lowers the value of M without changing J. And you just brute force do the calculation to show that they do that. So they're called raising and lowering operators. A lot, have you seen those simple harmonic oscillators? Simple harmonic oscillators, you have these things too. But you act on this relationship with a lowering operator. And so you're over here, you're acting with J minus for electron 1 times J minus for electron 1 minus plus J 2 minus. This one only sees the first one, this one only sees the second one, and that's the total J minus over here. So you apply this here, you apply that there. Well, applying this here gives a certain coefficient. It's actually J times J plus 1 is 2. J minus acting on a J M state is J plus 1 minus M minus, what's that mean? And let's see, it's just that time that changes right there, times J and M minus 1. J, M minus 1. So the effect of this operator is to lower the value of M by 1. Right. And it turns out you've got this operator. It's there. And then this is just a numerical coefficient called the Clutch Gordon coefficient. So you get 1 times 2 minus 1 times 0 is the square root of 2 times the 1 zero state over here. So the right side is just the square root of 2 times 1 zero. On this side, okay, you get square root of a half times 3 halves minus a half times minus a half times the 1 half minus a half state. When this one hits the first one, that's crossed with a half, because this one doesn't see that one. This one sees that one and not this one, so if you actually get another term like this, what is this, 3/4 plus 1/4 is 1, so it's just 1. Then you get a half cross a half minus a half. So you can write a 1-0 state as a combination, a symmetric combination of a down and an up electron plus an up and a down electron. So this particular combination, okay, an up down plus a down up, that superposition of electron states has a definite value of J and M. And if they're both up, that has a definite value of J and M. Now I step them down again and I find that 1 minus 1 is going to have to be both down. So if you act with the J minuses again on this, it will take you to that, or you can see that that makes sense. If they're both down, well, okay, so we've got two states here, we've got one state here. That's three of the four states. We need one more. Well, it turns out there's an antisymmetric combination of those two middle ones. So it's the only linear combination of, okay, there's only one way to combine two up or two down, but you can have a down up and an up down. There's one more linearly independent combination of that one, and it has spin zero. It's a scalar state. It's basically to be an up down minus a down up. Why am I writing it that way? let's see. I forgot this root 2. There's a 1 over root 2 here. Alright, that keeps it normalized. These are all normalized. So this one also has a 1 over root 2, but it's got the difference of a half, cross a half, minus a half, minus a half, times a half. So when we have a product state like this, Joe, what we do is we find linear combinations of the products that lead us back to simple JM type systems. So now we find that here's the place this is useful. The electron configurations for helium, right? You can now ask, well, are the two electrons in the singlet state or the triplet state? So the two electrons could combine to give a total spin of 1, and then you could put a magnetic field on it. You do a Stern-Gerlach thing, and it'll split into three beams. You pass it through an inhomogeneous magnetic field, and that Z component interacts differently and gives a little force and separates the beam, so you can actually separate out these three parts. So if helium is in this triplet configuration, you can measure that. Or you just get one beam out. Well, I think this is the one that it is. I think it takes the singlet state. This is lower energy. It keeps those anti-aligned, and they like that. So I think the electrons in helium tend to be in that singlet state. It has to do with the symmetry, the overall symmetry of the wave function. It has to be odd.
because it's or well, it has to be whatever it has to be. It has to be something, and you sort out the lowest energy state of helium. You want to put these in. You'd like to put them in both in S states. Well, they've got to be in opposite spins to both be in an S state. So I think the lowest energy state would be that scalar combination of the two.
What's the energy band shoot array? If you put a magnetic field on an atom and then shoot a laser at it, the absorption.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's just the same.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, instead of making a beam of the atom.
Right.
It's like
shoot beam.
Yeah.
Does
that happen?
Yeah.
So you'll work through examples of this. It's an easy procedure to do. You know, I like to treat this procedure. You know, just okay. So here's how we can write down all the states from some product state. These coefficients, well, the only coefficients are 1 and 1 over the square root of 2.